Any preliminary questions, issues? Yeah. Yes. It is on Monday, by the way. Yeah, go ahead. Is this your first exam, right? Okay. There is this program called ExamSoft, which you can use on a laptop. Basically, any laptop currently in use has enough horsepower for it. Except, I don't think it runs on a Mac. It only runs on a Windows system. But you can download the software. I think you just go to examsoft.com. I don't know if anybody who's done this who can report on it. Yeah. Somebody, correct me if I'm wrong. Go ahead. Okay, good. So follow the instructions in the email. And I assume that works. And yeah. I would recommend actually sort of, I think you can play around with it a little bit in advance so that you're familiar with how it works and so forth. Yeah. Oh. I haven't thought this through. My initial what I'd like to do is be consistent with all the other professors, and I guess that's what I will do. I'll consult with them and find out what. I don't think we should have local option on this. I think there ought to be a consistent pattern within the law school. My own impulse is to say, go ahead and use spell check. But spell check, by the way, doesn't solve the problem to the extent that it only identifies misspelled words. It doesn't identify the correct spelling of a word or the improper use of a word that's correctly spelled but out of place. People have asked me about this, and first of all, I want to make sure that my highest priority, even if you're a terrible speller and your grammar is atrocious and you need remedial writing help, if your analysis is good, that's by far the most important thing. But I should say that sometimes it's hard to present a persuasive good analysis if you can't write for beans. Oftentimes your ability to communicate an idea is dependent upon your ability to communicate that idea. And if you don't communicate it very well, I'm not sure exactly what your idea is. There's also some aspect I can't help acknowledging this, that to the extent that I am looking at relative performance, I'm looking at, and this raises the perhaps uncomfortable subject of the function of grading and of comparative grading. And let me make my little speech here, since I have the floor. My little speech is this. Sort of my educational hero is Jaime Escalante. For those of you who don't know him, he is the character in Stand and Deliver. It's a true story. It's a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen it, you should go rent it. The story of a calculus teacher in a tough part of Los Angeles who taught his students how to pass the AP calculus exam. And when he started, at least according to the movie, and I think that reflects at least a Hollywoodized version of the truth, everybody said, oh, no, these kids can't do that. They're, don't waste your time, this is crazy. And he wouldn't give up and said, no, these kids can do it, and he taught them calculus. And by the time, the first time a bunch of them passed the AP calculus exam, what did the Educational Testing Service do? Investigate him for cheating. Investigate the students for cheating. And in their defense, it wasn't just racism that what are a bunch of Hispanic kids from East Los Angeles doing, passing the AP calculus exam. They were concerned about the fact that where the students got answers wrong, they consistently got the same answers wrong in the same way. So it showed up as a kind of suspicious pattern for them. It turned out, though, that Jaime Escalante had a very rigid system of teaching them how to do problems, and when they got it wrong, they all got them wrong in a similar way. So they all had to retake the calculus exam, and they all passed it again. Anyway, my purpose in telling you this story is that Jaime Escalante didn't grade his students among one another and say, essentially, you know, it's like a game of musical chairs or, you know, sort of lifeboat ethics. What he said is, in effect, all of you who are able to achieve this goal of passing the AP calculus exam, I will cheer you on to do that. And I wish I were in a situation in which I could cheer all of you on to pass some test like the bar exam, which was out there, and I would not grade each of you relative to one another. I would figure out whatever I could do, and like Jaime Escalante, trying to figure out how can I get students to achieve this externally referenced goal. And I think it poisons the educational climate. I'm on my soapbox here. But I think it poisons the educational climate when you are all, in effect, competing with one another to see who will be at the top of the class and who will escape being at the bottom of the class. But that's the world we live in. I've been unsuccessful in persuading my colleagues that we ought to try very hard to interest the multi-state bar examiners, for example, in allowing us to give some form of the bar exam early, as they do in medical school, by the way. In medical school, medical students, after their second year, take the boards. And that's the exam on anatomy and biochemistry and all the stuff they have to learn. And after they pass that exam, then they do they focus heavily on clinical rotations and that sort of thing. We could do exactly the same thing. In fact, it was proposed by a guy named Tony Gallenberg, president of the American Bar Association, 10 or 12 years ago. As I say, it's not that it couldn't be done, but the world we live in essentially says that we report to potential employers and whoever else is interested of where you stand relative to one another. I sat on a hiring committee for a while when I was in private practice here in Spokane and read resumes, screened resumes to figure out who we were going to interview for jobs. And quite frankly, I paid no attention to a person's GPA because I couldn't figure out what the GPA was or what it was relative to other people. I looked at class rank. You know, if you were 10th in your class or 156th out of 175, that to me was the relevant criterion for how you performed academically. Footnote. How you perform academically is not the be-all and end-all of your existence. It's the part of your existence that I have something to do with. At least that's the part I give a grade to. I hope I have some influence on the rest of your life, what sort of a human being you're becoming, what sort of a lawyer you are 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. As I look back on Guido Calabresi and George Fletcher, who were professors I had in law school, Robert Bork was a professor I had, Grant Gilmore, Joe Goldstein, people that had a big influence on me, aside from the fact that, they gave more or less meaningless grades. But to the extent that I have some role in the way you are presented to the world, aside from writing you a letter of recommendation, if that turns out to be something that is useful, my major role is in assigning grades. And I do that, again, relativistically to some extent. I'm trying to present as fair a picture as I can of where a student stands relative to other students and also relative. I like the GPA at some point to reflect my assessment of you objectively speaking, independently speaking, not relativistically, but absolutely as a lawyer. If I give you a C+, I'm saying, in effect, you're doing an adequate job. You could, if you did this kind of job as a lawyer, you could avoid malpractice. hardly a ringing endorsement, but to the extent that's my job, in effect, to say if you got C pluses all the way through law school, we'd hand you a diploma at the end, and you'd, if you'd pass the bar, you'd get a license to be responsible for other people's liberty and fortunes. If I give you a lower grade than that, it's saying, you know, I hope in other areas of your law school career you're making up for this so that on balance you're doing an adequate job, but to the extent that we're falling below that, I'm seeing deficiencies that make your representation of a client sufficiently troublesome that if that's the way you performed all the time, we wouldn't give you a law degree. Now, above that C-plus level, there are varying shades of, again, gee, this isn't just an adequate job. The average grade, as it turns out, is something like a B-. So what I say, in effect, is you're doing an average job. There are people who do a better job, there are people who do a worse job, but this is an average job. A B, a little better than average. B-plus is we're getting into a fairly distinctive range. An A-minus or an A is essentially, gee, of all the students I have, there are a handful of students who really just impress the heck out of me, and that's the grade at the end that they get. And this all by way of commentary on spelling and grammar. Very long digression, but I hope useful to you. The question about spelling and grammar is part of saying, in effect, with what degree of enthusiasm do I recommend this student to their future clients? And spelling and grammar to me are like what you wear. Coming from me, that's a pretty strange thing to say, since my taste in clothes is notoriously abominable. But if I go to court, I'm going to be much more conscious of the physical appearance that I make on behalf of my client. I can have a brilliant legal argument, but if I show up, you know, having forgotten to shave that morning, and otherwise looking like I slept in my clothes and just rolled out of bed, that's not going to do a very good job for my client. So again, the most important thing is substance, because you can get a secretary or you can get someone else to fix up your brief and correct your grammar and spelling mistakes, but at some point, it does. I was a Supreme Court. I'm not a clerk for the Washington, for the Idaho Supreme Court. And when we got briefs that were full of misspellings and grammatical mistakes and were poorly organized and so forth, it had an impact on the impression we had of the seriousness of this person's attention to detail. If they're going to be careless about that, how do I know they're not being careless about the facts? Now, you may be saying to yourself, at this late stage in my career, it's a little late for me to suddenly become a grammar and spelling maven, but some of those things really are, you can pay attention to them, you can get better at it. I'm just being honest with you that it's not that it makes it, that it has absolutely nothing to do with with the way I evaluate the quality of your work. Again, 90-some-odd percent, 95%, 98% of it is how well do you do spotting the issues and explaining them and organizing them. But some residual percentage is how well can you express yourself. Response? As I said earlier, I'm going to defer to my colleagues. I'm sorry I don't know that right now. I'm going to have to find out what the general consensus is. I want to be consistent with that. My own personal inclination is to let you use it, because in the real world, you get to use it. So I like having conditions that are as realistic as possible. For those of you, and I think those of you who are used to writing by hand as opposed to people, to the extent that you're writing by hand and you feel you're at a competitive disadvantage, you're essentially coming in with a bow and arrow and somebody else has an M1A1 tank, and it's not a fair fight. I would say that there isn't that dramatic a difference, and quite frankly, I think it's a free country, and to the extent that everybody has the freedom to learn how to be proficient at a keyboard, it's actually a good thing, you know, later on in your legal career, more and more skills at a keyboard are handy for people who are in the business of practicing law. So I don't feel too bad about, in effect, saying this is, to the extent there's an advantage, it's an advantage you can acquire and you probably should. But again, more important is what you feel comfortable with, and many people are quite proficient, and I haven't done the statistics to figure out what the grading difference is. My recollection when people have looked at this is that there is no discernible difference, that the people who handwrite and the people who use a computer are essentially indistinguishable in terms of, you know, it's not like the people who use the computer have a 0.5 GPA higher than anyone. Did I answer your question eventually? Sort of. Punted. I before E except after C or in sounding like A as in neighbor and what? I mean, you know, it is a sad commentary on our educational system that we don't. I mean, I was drilled into this. I'm an old geezer, and when I was a little kid, you know, I still remember that stuff. And now we are preoccupied with other things in our educational system, and kids don't know how to spell or add and subtract, and you all have been the victims of that, unfortunately. Mr. Phillips? Yes, yeah. Right, in terms of the laptop, I mean, I'm going to ask my colleagues to indulge me, to allow me to get in. I'm going to be here at 10 minutes to 11 on Monday morning so that the people who write by hand will have adequate time to grab a blue book and sit down, and I can give you the exam, and we can start promptly at 11. I'm also going to ask the indulgence of whoever follows me on Monday. I'm not sure there is somebody who follows me on Monday. Is there a class in here on Monday? At noon? Okay. Well, but I'm not sure whether this room is used. I don't think it is. If the room isn't used, I'm going to take the full hour so that we can start at 11 and finish at noon. With respect to class at 1, I'm not sure. I'll have to figure that out. But it may be 55 minutes. If I have to, I'll stop it at 55 minutes. And so then you have 5 minutes to pick up your stuff and drop your blue book off. So I'll have a box at the front. You essentially grab a blue book when you come in and write it, and when you're done, you drop it off. For the people who are doing the examinator, or not the exam, the exam soft stuff that's in, what happens is you get handed a disk as you come in, a little floppy disk. You all need to have a floppy disk drive, by the way, if you're going to use exam soft. And you take this disk, you stick it in. As you're going along, it periodically saves a backup copy, so in case the thing blows up, you have recourse. And then at the end, you save it, hand in the floppy disk, and that's it. Works relatively easily. Ma? I've rarely, if ever, given an F. What I'm looking for in these answers, and what you should be looking for, is a kind of, you know, this is a dipstick reading. We're just kind of taking a check at what's going on there, and if there need to be major corrections to the way you're doing stuff, you have a chance to do it. You also have a chance to sort of see what I'll do Monday afternoon at the Q&A, and I'm going to film it. I've actually filmed it before, and I've got a copy of that someplace. If you want, I've even got it online. If you want to, it's bad. It's a bad copy. It's hard to see. This time I hope to do it right, so you can actually. But you can watch me grading an exam. And I sometimes. I used to compare it when Gary Trudeau was better known in Doonesbury. He had one sequence where who's the reporter Roland Hadley or whatever his name is, the guy with the explorer hat and so forth. But the series was called Inside Reagan's Brain, and he's going like looking at the stalactites and the stalagmites in a Carlsbad cavern or something. And I think of that when you watch me grading an exam, not just because I sort of think like Ronald Reagan, but because I have a version of his Alzheimer's. And what you see is not necessarily pretty, but you get a chance to kind of, that's what it looks like from that end. So that as you prepare for future exams, you have a better idea. Okay, this is the kind of thing that does me well, and this is the kind of stuff that sounded like a good idea, but it turned out to be a waste of time or worse. So again, such as it is, this process of evaluation is less of a black box whose innards you have no way of knowing about, and it becomes something more tangible to you. I want to emphasize the way in which the function of getting good at taking law school exams is, alas, the only thing we evaluate in this law school, that and writing papers. There is a whole lot more we could evaluate, and in my humble opinion, we should evaluate about your suitability, your talents to be a good lawyer. The qualities that you look for in a lawyer, I think, are partially the ability to write good law school exams. That's a skill, an analytical skill, an expressive skill. I don't want to minimize the importance of that, but I would say in looking at what you want in a lawyer, far more important are things like character, integrity, willingness to work hard, sympathy for other people, a grounding in some kind of stable worldview that keeps you from going crazy when that's a strong temptation. Those are the characteristics that make for good lawyers, and you can be a great lawyer with modest skills in taking a fact pattern and spotting all the issues and spouting all the rules and applying them and reaching conclusions. But that's the only part I evaluate. And so I guess I keep sort of blaming the system what I'm really trying to communicate here is that you have a right to be unhappy with certain aspects of the way this whole system works. And I'm not saying you would be wrong to be unhappy with that, but I also want to direct you in the areas where you're most likely to see something change and figure out, okay, this, as the AA philosophy said, I don't know exactly where it came from, I want the courage to change the things I can change. I want the serenity to accept the things I can't change, and I want the wisdom to know the difference. And the aspects about what you can do about your law school experience to make it what you want it to be, figuring out, okay, these are the things I can change, these are the things I can't change, I've got to live with them, and discerning the difference. Any other cosmic thoughts? Yeah, Mr. Reich? Yeah. Yes. The audience is your client. So even though I'm looking over your shoulder as you write this to the client and I'm listening to what you say, the standard is you shouldn't be craning your neck to say, oh, by the way, Professor DeWolf, the reason I'm... What you want to do is essentially say, dear client, my evaluation of your situation is this. You would have a strong case in this area because the elements for this kind of a claim are such and so, and as I read the facts, they seem to suggest you could make out each of these elements, and I don't think the defendant would be able to argue blah, 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 because, you know, for this reason. On the other hand, there's this other area which we might have thought about, but it really isn't going to work because blah, 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 blah. So again, as you explain this to the client, it's the in many ways the most challenging thing. Irving Younger used to say that trying cases is the most challenging thing you ever do as a lawyer, not only because of all the time pressures, but because of the requirement of translating very complicated things into something simple that makes the jury think, that makes the client think, this is manageable. You don't want to give the client the impression, this is a huge hullabaloo about which I will never, you know, I'll never understand this. Hopefully my lawyer understands it, because apparently it's so damn complicated you want your client to at least have the feeling, I think I can track what's going on. I don't know these subtleties, but the more you can bring your client into it, again, it's the same skill as convincing a jury, or for that matter, a judge. Judges aren't that much different from juries in the sense that they, too, are unfamiliar with this complicated thing. Your job is to kind of create a little yellow brick road that they can, you know, walk down and, okay, it leads from here to there. Now, it's different from talking to a jury or a judge in that when you talk to a jury or a judge, you're polarized. You have an agenda, and you want to accomplish that agenda. With your client, you're not in the position of being a cheerleader so much as you are in the position of being an analyst. As I sort of break open this problem, it seems to fall out like this. Here are the strengths, here are the weaknesses. We could try this, but I'm not sure about that. Maybe this fact could be interpreted this way, but I don't know. It seems kind of dubious. Exactly. That's what they want to know, because eventually they're going to have to make a decision. Do they pull out their checkbook and write you a big check to defend them, or write a big check to the plaintiff to pay this off? Does the plaintiff hire you to represent them? Do you tell your client, I know you're terribly injured, I know, you know, you really need somebody to help you out, but as I look at this, I don't see a basis for liability, and quite frankly, I wouldn't take your case. Even if I get a third of your recovery, I'm not going to make any money, so far as I can tell, because quite frankly, this one's a loser. So you want to be able to make the evaluation both for your client and ultimately also for yourself as a lawyer about, is this game worth the candle? What should we do with it? And these are judgments about which, you know, reasonable minds often differ, but the more, this again is why law school emphasizes issue spotting. Because being able to sort of think globally, to think creatively, think outside the box a little bit, to see what's coming over the horizon before it actually gets here, will give you the chance oftentimes to do better than if you're simply reacting to stuff that kind of clobbers you over the head and, gee, I never saw that one coming. The more you can kind of look out over the horizon, well, gee, you can do this and you might be able to do that. Well, this wouldn't work, and if they tried this, we'd have this answer for it. That's, again, this kind of analytical skill, thinking like a lawyer, as well as making good judgments to say, that one ain't going to fly. So again, I think as you go look at the sample answers to the exams, I hope you pick up that stylistic pattern of laying the problem out in a clear way, inclusive, but reasonably compact. That answer is one you can do in 55 minutes. All right? Causation. Sindel, I got a call at 10:45 this morning from an old friend of mine, Bob Crotty, who had has a client who served in Vietnam and was injured by some disease that is a fallout from the herbicides that were sprayed in that war. And so he wanted to know about market share liability. I said, funny you should ask. I'm just walking in to teach Sindel. So let's talk about Sindel here for a second. Who's in need of a little attention here? Who's willing to take it on here? Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, I can't see your name. Right. It wasn't a birth defect, but it was right. Well, yeah. Okay. It didn't work, by the way. It was ineffective. It. Okay. Right. This exposure caused health problems later on. Okay, and what we do, as I said yesterday, is we go basically through each of these theories and find out whether they will work. So the first one, as you say, is the rule in Summers versus Tice, also known as alternative liability. And what does the court say about whether that can be applied to this case? Why not? Right. We're literally talking about hundreds of manufacturers here. So the plaintiff is unable to bring, to be dealing from a full deck, and the court rules that the doctrine of alternative liability is only applicable in those cases in which all of the defendants who could have caused, or all of the tortfeasors who could have caused the injury are included as defendants in the suit. Okay, so alternative liability doesn't fly in this case. Now, the next theory, which we haven't really talked about yet, that the plaintiff wants to use, yeah, okay, concert of action or concerted action goes by both names. What's the gist of that kind of theory? More than that, yes, exactly. That there's some kind of conspiracy is malevolent a word, but the court actually gives an example of a kind of case in which concert of action could be applied. I think it's stuck in a footnote someplace. It's actually a drag race. That is cars we're talking about here, and the it's sort of like Meet the Parents, if you've seen that, when Ben Stiller and Robert De Niro show up at the stoplight, you know, and they motion to each other and zoom off. Or actually, I think Robert De Niro is the one who zooms off, and Ben Stiller goes off someplace else. But in any event, in that situation, if the plaintiff got injured but couldn't figure out which of the two drag racers actually ran over the plaintiff, then it wouldn't matter because you would say they egged each other on. They were, in effect, agents of each other. They formed this little partnership. They're vicariously liable for what the other people in their little group did on behalf of the group. Other examples might be, you know, some people decide on a Indian summer day like today, you have a balloon war. You know, you take surgical tubing and water balloons and, you know, launch them like little artillery pieces across the courtyard to your opponents in this war. Harmless fun, perhaps, but if somebody got hurt in that process, you could say that without identifying whose balloon actually clonked the plaintiff in the head, they would be, the group that had this idea could be held, in effect, jointly liable for it. Okay, how does that apply to Judith Sindel? Why not? What's missing that we would need to apply that theory? First of all, what does the plaintiff say in justification for trying to use this theory, in support of her theory? Correct? Right, and as you were saying earlier, they all did the same thing. It looks like they're, you see a bunch of people, you know, marching down the street and they're all in step. You sort of assume that that's a result of some prior agreement. But it turns out that sometimes people do parallel things, not because they've agreed to it in advance, but because it's to their mutual advantage. So if one gasoline dealer drops his price dramatically, another gasoline dealer may drop his price dramatically, and vice versa. If, in fact, that's pursuant to some advance agreement, if you lower your price, I'll lower my price, or if you raise your price, I'll raise my price, then that's an antitrust violation. So there's a big difference between simply parallel behavior, where everybody finds it to their advantage to do the same thing, and behavior that's the product of an agreement in advance. So the problem for Judith Sindel here is she can show they did the same thing, but not pursuant to some prior agreement. There's no evidence that the manufacturers got together in a, you know, hotel room in Las Vegas and said, let's all do this. They may have copied one another, just as competitors will use one another's techniques and copy things, but not pursuant to any kind of agreement. So concert of action doesn't really apply here either. There's a third theory, okay, or enterprise liability, and tell me about that. What's the gist of an enterprise liability theory? What's the example that's used? Okay. So again, I'm just giving little examples of this. Alternative liability, the example is Summers versus Tice. Concert of action, the example is a drag race. Enterprise liability, the example is the blasting cap case, Hall versus DuPont. What happens in Hall versus DuPont? Okay. And why is that? Why does that make a difference? Well, maybe they ought to be, but on what basis? In other words, what in fairness says that if all these people are negligent, but we can't figure out which one did the negligent thing, why is it we're all holding them negligent? What's the difference between that and saying, in effect, everybody who owns a blue car is subject to liability if my car out in the street gets hit by somebody? Yeah. Well, that turns out to be important and a distinguishing feature that's not present here. One of the reasons the court rejects the idea of enterprise liability in this case, because they said, well, in Hall versus DuPont, you had this very tightly organized industry, the blasting cap industry, and they had a trade association that functioned as a kind of governing board for them. But, yeah, go ahead, Mr. Boyer. Well, each of them did a negligent thing by selling these blasting caps without any kind of warning or without any protection in their marketing system from this kind of accident happening. Okay, meaning that they have an opportunity to do something good and they failed to do it. Reminiscent of Scrooge looking out, no, not Scrooge, but Marley's ghost looking out upon, it was Scrooge. When Scrooge is visited by Marley's ghost, he looks out on these shades, these specters in the night, and he sees them unable to do, who desperately want to do good but have lost the power forever. In enterprise liability, you have this trade association. They talk about chemical formulas. They talk about advertising. They talk about this. They talk about that. They don't talk about fixing prices, we hope, or they'll hear from the Justice Department. But when they do these other things and have a golden opportunity to do something for safety and miss that opportunity, the court says, when you control the risk to that extent, you have this opportunity and you fail to take it, then the enterprise can be held liable. So, if you will, the courts don't use this term, but it may help you. I sometimes refer to this as a concert of inaction. That's how it's different from concert of action. In concert of action, we plan together to do a negligent thing. In enterprise liability, as I say, we have this chance as an industry to do something and sit on our hands. That's the basis for saying then the enterprise can be held liable. But, as we were talking about earlier, that assumes you have a tightly organized body that had this regulatory capacity. Not only are there hundreds of companies involved here, but there's another obstacle to the drug companies providing safety measures corresponding to the safety measures that were expected in Hall versus DuPont. Why is that not to be expected in this case? Mr. Harris? There's sort of FDA preemption here. That is, the blasting cap industry could, in effect, regulate itself. You could expect them to adopt these safety measures. You can't expect the drug companies to get together and decide on the marketing practices for their drugs, because the FDA would say, who do you think you are anyway? The FDA would kick them out of a regulatory function because the FDA jealously protects that. So again, you can't say of this industry, as was said of the blasting cap industry in Hall versus DuPont, why didn't you guys do something about this? If you're going to blame somebody, blame the FDA. So again, enterprise liability doesn't work. But we ain't done yet. The plaintiff has yet another theory to use. What's that? Yes. And how does that work? Okay, and where does this come from? Where does this whole theory come from? What does the court rely upon in adopting this theory? A student comment in a law review article, which is to tell you that you may have an influence greater than what you might anticipate. Did the court do the wrong thing by turning to a student for guidance? Not necessarily if the student has a good idea. And the court believes the student does have a good idea here in permitting the plaintiffs to recover, although we haven't determined on what exactly how we're going to divide this up, but the general concept that the plaintiff can recover in these cases without being able to identify who caused her injury, the court seems to think is an improvement over saying, I'm sorry, we can't play that. Now, the court sets up some guidelines here, assuming we have a kind of classic, you know, market here, a pie chart in effect, where each of the defendants is identified as a market share. What does the plaintiff have to establish in order to be entitled to this market share theory? Okay, now the first principle would be we're assuming all of these defendants did in effect the same thing, that we're talking about some kind of generic, the term used is fungible product. That's a term from the UCC, the idea that, you know, a carload of wheat, soft white wheat, is interchangeable with any other carload of soft white wheat, as opposed to things that are not fungible, like a painting or a house or something that is not simply a generic and one can substitute for the other. So in this case, it's clear that each of the defendants sold a product that was identical. And as you look at cases where it's proposed to use market share, it's often difficult to decide, are we talking about a generic product, a fungible product, or are we talking about different products? Okay, so we want to say that they're all selling a generic product. We're also saying that their negligence is, in effect, it's like Summers, it's a modified form of Summers versus Tice, in that we also assume that all the defendants acted negligently in the same way. They all failed to adequately research this or warn about the dangers of the product. How much of the market does the plaintiff need to identify and bring into court to be entitled to this market share theory? A substantial share. We don't know what that means. Is that 5%? Is it 60%? Is it 90%? What is the threshold the plaintiff needs to meet in order to be able to play this game? To some extent, I think that issue becomes moot by the court's disposition of the case in Brown versus Superior Court, where we get down to the brass tacks of figuring out, is this a joint liability? Is it an individual percentage share liability? How are we going to divide that up? And again, I don't want to get too deeply into that because it's one of the topics in Chapter 6, but we'll have to say something about it when we get to Brown versus Superior Court. But just to finish up with Sindel here, market share depends upon, first of all, a fungible product. All the defendants are negligent. And the plaintiff has named a substantial share. Now, as the opinion suggests, not everybody's happy with this. I think it's just is it Justice Richardson who writes a dissenting opinion saying, wow, you know, we've really taken a walk on the wild side here. It's one thing to impose strict liability against product manufacturers even when they haven't been negligent. It's another thing, yet again, to say you're liable if you sell this product even though we can't determine whether the product you sold actually injured the plaintiff who's seeking damages. So this is way too exotic for his tastes. Now, again, in the next case, Brown versus Superior Court, I should tell you there are actually two issues that the court resolves, and one of them has to do with the standard of liability, and that is discussed in Chapter 9 under product liability. But the aspect of causation and the way in which liability is imposed, that's something we look at here. And it turns out by that point, all the justices agree on it. So on Tuesday, we'll pick up again with that issue.